This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm joined in the studio by
Arvind Yuvaraj
and Christine Wong.
As per usual, we're going to be with you all the way through until 1 p.m. this afternoon. If you want to get in touch, get us on Twitter at BFM Radio or on WhatsApp on 018-789-8899. I'll give you that number again because you might want to use it a little bit later on. 018-789-8899. We have a story coming up later on in the show about the CEO of a particular company who thinks it's okay to text people at weird hours and at the weekend. We'd like to get some feedback as to whether or not you think that is acceptable or not. Should your boss be texting you on the weekend and at weird hours?
Not even your boss, by the way. People she hasn't even hired yet.
Oh, dear.
Job candidates,
right? Okay, so that's story number three. First up, in a couple of minutes, we have a story about how the new Lego invention can sort cells and molecules. What can't Lego do nowadays? Story number two. Funding societies and Money Match, they're launching a strategic partnership to provide alternative financial solutions for SMEs. Mm-hmm. We then have the third story. The CEO of Barstool Sports defends testing job candidates by texting them at weird hours and on weekends. Story number four. Southeast Airlines looked at non-stop U.S. flights despite profit challenges. And then we'll be wrapping up with how EA, unsurprisingly, are one of America's most hated companies yet again.
Yep.
Right. So, story number one. Anything that Lego blocks can't do, right? Mm-hmm. People use them to solve Rubik Cube faster than ever. They create bionic arms. They've fixed crumbling monuments and build actual houses. Mm-hmm. Yes, they have. And now MIT scientists have figured out a way to use them for actual biomedical research. This isn't actually the first time that scientists have used Lego blocks for science. Back in 2014, researchers at Iowa University employed the Danish Toys for science research. According to the scientists in charge of the study, they used transparent Lego blocks to measure and contain gel and soil in plant growth environments. How cool is that? So this is all possible, they claimed, because of the precise nature of Lego's manufacturing methods. But more on that in a little minute. Right, so according to this new paper published in the journal Lab on a Chip, I love that name.
Yep.
This new research goes way further. They provide a method to build any kind of microfluidic laboratory in a matter of minutes just by using previously prepared Lego blocks. So if you don't know, microfluidics are the basis for Lab on a Chip devices regularly used in practical applications like DNA analysis, cell behavior, or molecular biology research.
Hmm.
We're dipping into bigger picture territory here, almost. So the team used micro-milling techniques and a CAD program to carefully draw a 500-micron-wide channel for fluids on the Lego blocks. They then, these tiny embossed lines, which are then sealed with a transparent adhesive, are carefully laid out so that each brick's channel input and output can precisely align with the next and previous brick. So this allows scientists to easily assemble any microfluidic laboratory, something that before required expensive custom prototyping and manufacturing methods. So wow. They've basically milled out just a little bit of a Lego block, stuck them all together, and that saved them an awful lot of money.
But I still don't understand, like, how? Like, what? So I saw the piece and then I tried to figure out what exactly Lego is doing, but I still can't comprehend it fully.
Because of how precise the manufacturing process of Lego blocks are, so when you make a Lego block and then the machine makes another Lego block, the specifications are so accurate that it's within proportion, it's within what's the right word I'm looking for? Christine, help me out.
I don't know words anymore today.
You don't know words today. It's so accurate that on a molecular level, you can create a channel. And the next Lego block, if you do it in exactly the same space, it will be perfectly aligned.
In
the Lego block, at a molecular level, because they are so well manufactured.
So if you put a bunch of Lego blocks next to each other, it's perfectly in line.
They will be perfectly in line.
On a molecular level.
Wow.
The Lego blocks. Wow.
Right? It's really clever. The MIT explains that the reason they could do this with Lego is that the blocks' high manufacturing precision standards, here we go, made of acrylonitrile butadiene styrene, ABS, a hard plastic that gets injected inside custom-made molds and machines. So Lego blocks have an extremely low margin of error. The molds get retooled after short periods of time to guarantee that every single piece is perfect. And they get discarded when they can't be retooled anymore. So there you go. They're so accurate, you can use them for almost anything.
I'm not surprised, though. You know, I mean, in my childhood, I remember, you know, stacking Lego blocks together, but then you can't pry them apart because there's no, like, ridge or any kind of flaw where you can pry them apart with, and they're just stuck there, to the point where Lego released a tool specifically to pry their pieces apart. Yeah, yeah, they have.
I never saw that.
Yeah, yeah. No, they've actually done it so that you can save your fingernails. So you know, I'm actually not really surprised. And the capabilities of Lego as well. I'm just, you know, Lego is great. I remember, like, we made robots with Lego in computer class when I was younger.
Yeah.
And I was already like, this is so confusing because they're bricks, but they can move now because I made them move. This is blowing my mind. So I'm like, you go, Lego. I don't know what to say. You're just doing everything right.
All right. Yeah. Did we all have Lego as kids? Did you have
Lego? I did. Yeah.
I had a Lego train set, and it was one of those things. I remember my dad buying it for me, and it came in this enormous box, and I remember looking at it and going, yep, nope, I'm not doing that.
Oh,
because it's so complex.
Because it was so complex. Lego Technics it was.
But it's gone, like, super expensive now. I mean, to get any kind of Lego set. But I remember having, it used to be like the free set where you could build anything you want. So they had like the tree, they had like a garden, a house. And I used to build the same house over and over and over again, just with like different color combinations.
Right.
But you're right, I never realized that it didn't have gaps. Mm. That's why it looked so good. It didn't fall apart.
I think I remember reading a piece not too long ago that weight by weight, Lego is a better investment than gold because of how it holds its value.
Fantastic.
Right, okay, moving on to story number two. The funding societies and Money Match have launched a strategic partnership to provide alternative financial solutions for SMEs. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so they're doing this to broaden access to alternative financial services for Malaysian SMEs. So funding societies is Malaysia's first and largest P2P financing platform. It's actually known as Modalku in Singapore and India. They've also disbursed about 300 million ringgit in working capital financing to SMEs across more than 2,000 deals in this region alone. And Money Match is a cheaper and faster online-based cross-border money transfer platform that's approved by Bank Negara. So since they launched just in October 2017, they've handled about 38 million in transactions over about 56 countries. So both of these startups, fintech solutions, they've come together to sort of provide SMEs with more options for financing. Money Match will refer the clients in need of business financing to funding societies, and then SMEs can decide if they want to go ahead with the arrangement or not. Mm. And this partnership wants to provide SMEs with more options, like I said. And like if an SME is making a purchase of, let's say, inventory somewhere overseas, they can use fintech solutions from both funding societies and Money Match. So what the SME can do is they can get working capital financing with no collateral requirements from funding societies to fund the purchase. And they can also perform remittance payments with lower fees and better exchange rates using Money Match.
I noticed they have their own proprietary eKYC system, the KYC being Know Your Customer. Mm-hmm, so I'm guessing it's all online, kind of.
It's all online.
Give us your passport details or your IC details. Yeah. And, you know, interesting stuff.
It is fully online, especially Money Match. They say that it's a complete online platform. Mm. The partnership also supports initiatives from government bodies like the Securities Commission and Bank Negara to digitize financial solutions. Funding societies normally connect SMEs with investors through the online marketplace and invest in SMEs, and then the investors could also earn returns of up to 14% per year.
Wow!
Which is higher than the fixed deposits and bonds and all the other traditional stuff. And on the other end of the spectrum, SMEs could get up to 500,000 in working capital financing to expand their business. And they don't have to provide any collateral, and funding societies make sure that the interest costs are minimized due to the short financing tenors.
Nice.
Great ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. And I mean, basically, the problem right now is, according to what Securities Commission is saying, is that the Malaysian SME sector has a financing gap of more than 80 billion ringgit. So it kind of makes sense for both these startups to come together and provide alternative solutions to sort of maybe make that gap slightly smaller for these SMEs.
I'm going to say, anything we can do to kind of help lift the SMEs out a little bit would be very useful, right?
Oh, yeah.
Mm. What else was I going to say? I've completely lost my train of thought. Never mind. What we'll do is we'll go into an advert break right now. But ladies and gents, don't forget, we did ask you earlier on if you are interested to talk about this story. The CEO of Barstool Sports, which will be our next story, she is defending testing job candidates by texting them at weird hours and on a weekend. Let us know how you feel about that. We're going to take a short break. We've got some Steppenwolf coming up right now with Hey Lordy Mama. That's coming up right here on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Breaking Financial Matters, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. We are moving on to story three, but if you missed the first two stories, we had a story about how a new Lego invention can sort cells and molecules. Mm-hmm. Arvin then told us about the funding societies and Money Match launching a strategic partnership to provide alternative financial solutions for SMEs. We've asked you to text in and message about this next story. The CEO of Barstool Sports defends testing job candidates by texting them at weird hours on a weekend. Christine, tell us more.
Yeah, so this is Erica Nardini, who is the CEO of Barstool Sports. And she told the New York Times that part of her vetting process for interviewing job candidates is to text them at weird hours. She said, if you're in the process of interviewing with us, I'll text you about something at like 9 p.m. or 11 a.m. on a Sunday just to see how fast you'll respond. She's also admitted that her management and hiring style might not be entirely positive and that she understood how the practice might incite some controversy, but that's how she's quote-unquote wired.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly, when I read this, it just made me really furious because I'm the kind of person that feels, you know, that you should have your work life and you should have your home life and you should have time to actually, you know, have a downtime and not think about work. But after the story was published, Barstool Sports actually posted a response on their website, and the response said that people complaining about Nardini's hiring process must, quote, not see the connection between working hard and success.
There's some truth to that, I'd imagine. Mm. Yeah.
So in their minds, they're thinking that this is just to make sure that you will respond to these kinds of messages, that you will, that you're willing to work hard, you're willing to be involved in the conversation. And they were also saying that if you want to be a sports writer, you can almost definitely expect to work when the games are on nights and weekends as well.
Yeah,
so that is a good point. However, a lot of experts on work-life balance say that emailing or kind of being in contact with employees after hours can work to the team's detriment. For example, Maura Thomas, the founder of RegainYourTime.com, wrote in the Harvard Business Review that being always on hurts results. Because when employees are constantly monitoring their email after work hours, they're missing out on essential downtime that brains need. And Thomas recommends that company leaders set up policies to support a work culture that values single-tasking, focus, and downtime instead. So on the one hand, I get it. You know, it is important for employees to be responsive. But on the other hand, you know, you need time away from work as well. But I don't know. What do you guys think?
Okay. If you're an accountant and you can turn off your work at 5 p.m. on a Monday to Friday, I think it's entirely reasonable that if your boss messages you outside of those hours that you should be able to say, you know, I don't need to respond to that. You know, I'm out of work. But if you work for the media or if you work for a company that is providing sports coverage or if you're a blogger or, you know, anything like that, I think it's very difficult to have that downtime that we require, you know, and that's part and parcel of the job in the industry that we get ourselves into, right?
Yeah.
And I think she has a valid point where she's saying, you know, this kind of thing is a normal occurrence, I guess, in the industry that she's in.
I guess another thing is social media. Like if you are the social media manager or you're handling like someone's Twitter, someone's Facebook, and someone sends you a message, then they have, they sort of have like staggered teams to work throughout the day. I think unless it's like in the middle of the night, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., then no one replies. But if you're on social media and then someone sends you a message and you don't reply till the next day, then it's a problem for that company. Then it reflects badly. But I think other than that, like if it's about a project that you can do the next day at work or you can respond when you're physically at the office the next day and someone keeps sending you messages and needing you to reply, then it's wrong.
Right.
Because people need to have like lives, right? They want to go do things after work and stuff, and you can't expect them to reply and you can't penalize them for not getting back to you on time.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I do understand that. You know, when it comes to kind of important things or kind of emergency situations or things like that, that, you know, you should be responsive. And I'm the kind of person that can't leave a message unread. So I will read and respond, you know, whenever I get that kind of stuff. But at the same time, I just feel like, you know, you have to have that balance, and you have to be able to turn off your brain from thinking about work all the time. And while she does have a good point in terms of she said that when she got to Barstool, she saw how alive it was, how constant it was, and anyone who works in news and information or in sports understands that most things happen on nights and weekends.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like specifically for that, in terms of those kinds of jobs that do require you to work like non-traditional hours, fine. But in that sense also, then just stick to communicating during those hours where you are working as well, not like taking it out of context where they're definitely not working at all. That's kind of my point of view.
I mean, the other side of the coin of that is, or rather to add to it, let's say, for example, you have people here who have been keeping track of the U.S. Super Bowl, for example.
Yep.
And, of course, you've got that ridiculous time zone difference, and you have people here who are having to get up at 4:30 a.m. to go and report on the Super Bowl that I think was kicking off at 6 a.m. the other morning. You know, and they've got to send their reports back home from what the Malaysian audience was. So the idea of traditional work hours nowadays, it's one of those really weird things, isn't it? But I completely agree with what you're saying, Chris. I mean, I am a big advocate of switching off and having my time to kind of refresh my brain, if you like. But on the other hand, there are times when we've got to go to events after work, we've got to go to events on a weekend, and all that kind of, and it sounds like, oh, well, you know, you're complaining about going to events. It's not... it's not fun most of the time.
It's a work event.
And so you're constantly working, and your brain is constantly switched on. And that is why so many people in this industry end up burning out at a much earlier age, or why they move to drink, or why they move to some other kind of substance, or they do something else. You know, it's completely understandable. You know, and I can see why a lot of younger people are coming out and saying, no, we don't want to do this. But in her defense, she's like, well, you're on social media all the time. You're doing your Facebook. You're doing your Twitter. Like you've just said, Harvey.
Yeah, but then that's their own choice.
That's leisure.
Right. That's leisure. So,
right.
There's this thing where people used to use the words work-life balance before. But if you ask anybody now, the term is outdated. People they just don't say work-life balance because you don't have to balance two and two. It's supposed to be work, and then you're supposed to have whatever you do in your other life outside of work. And it's not supposed to clash with one another. My previous job, I used to go to work at sometimes 2 a.m. in the morning, so it used to be at night, and then I used to come back in the mornings. I used to give it like an hour before and an hour after for any problems that pop up. If my supervisor wanted to get in touch, or something wasn't working well and they wanted to check on something, or the reports or whatever. But any time after that would be a bit annoying, because it's my time to do things that I want to do outside of work. So I don't want to be constantly checking the emails and stuff about, you know, something that went down. It's supposed to be the job of the person who comes in after me. So in that case, then you can't test me or use that against me if I don't get back to you on time. I'm supposed to get back to you maybe an hour before I go into work the following day. But if I am on social media at that time and someone sends me like a message and they ask about, oh, when is this happening, and I don't get back to them on time, then you can penalize me because I'm supposed to respond like in an hour or so.
Yeah, so my kind of, the way that I approach this is that for all the kind of my emails, for example, I've switched off the function on my phone that downloads them automatically. So I control when I look at my emails. Number one, because I can't stand looking at the badge, the little red badge that just says you have unread emails.
And the battery.
But also because that's my way of saying, okay, when I'm not actively looking at emails, I'm not actively looking at emails, and I'm off. That's not it. But if people do want to contact me for whatever reason, they can reach me on like my direct line. So like my WhatsApp, text me, call me, Instagram message me. I don't know, right?
And that's the thing, right? The whole WhatsApp grouping thing now. You know, I mean, it's not a new thing, but it has become the bane of my existence sometimes. You know, when it's ping, 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 whether or not it's work or not. You know, there's family groups, there's auntie groups, there's uncle groups. Yeah, you know, there's meme, all of these things, you know, but especially the work ones, and I'm like I just said earlier on, outside of those work hours, I'm just like, please just leave me alone just for these, you know, 48 hours, just leave me alone for that 48 hours. But you know that part of you is like, I need to check this, you know, and that's kind of ingrained.
Yeah, I mean, within the kind of WhatsApp group thing, if it's not totally urgent, if I can tell that's not urgent, you know, necessarily, I'll just be like, okay, cool, note it, and then that's it, right? But, you know, it's just in case that it is urgent, I don't mind that at all. I just think that the concept of bringing work home so much and not really turning off your brain, it's just unhealthy.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think the bringing work home thing, I wouldn't be, I'm not so iffy about that, because I think I've always done it ever since I started working. I think that's the nature of the beast kind of thing. I don't know. It's just like me, I sort of I blend the two, and I sort of don't stick to the 9-hour thing. But I'm okay getting those WhatsApp messages messages. I'm okay getting them in the weekends, at night, whenever. But if I don't get back to the messages, if I'm doing something else at that time, then it shouldn't be held against me.
Yeah.
That's my biggest thing.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be like, oh, why didn't you reply in 5 minutes or 15? This was an emergency. If it's not working hours, and even if it is an emergency, I shouldn't be held accountable if I don't get back to the messages in time.
It'd be interesting to know what you folks at home think about this. You know, is there a divide amongst people? You know, do we sit on one side of the fence? Is it okay to text people outside of work hours if you feel as though you need to, if it's an emergency, for example,
mm-hmm.
or not? Let us know. Get us on WhatsApp, 018-789-8899, or get us on Twitter at BFM Radio. BFM Radio. In the meantime, music coming up. It is Supergrass. And then when we come back, we'll be talking about how a Southeast Asian airline are looking to have non-stop US flights despite profit challenges. I wonder if a certain other airline is listening. You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. Before we move on to story number four, we asked you about your opinion of whether or not it was okay to text workers or potential job candidates outside of working hours. And we asked you to text in, and we asked you to send us tweets. We've had a few responses. Christine, take it away.
Yeah, so on WhatsApp, we have a couple of messages. We have one from the a number, last four digits, 5123, who says, all my senior staff were given an option to have company phones and company lines, which have to be on 24/7. Because our business needs connectivity with our customers. Everyone agreed and accepted the rules.
Because they got a free phone.
I guess so. But also, you know, if that is a company policy, yep. then it's really hard to say no.
Yep, yep.
Another one, last four digits, 4578, said, there's no such thing as switching off after work if you're doing IT in a banking or a FSI environment, especially in Malaysia. Bosses expect you to respond when there is an incident, being hardware failure, batch run failure, or a security incident. So I guess in some industries, it's a lot more difficult to switch off after hours as well. Then we have some tweets in from at Brenda is a Rebel saying that any boss or figure of authority who breaches their employees' work-life balance for the sake of quote-unquote testing them can get in the sea, in my opinion. How cruel and unnecessary. Besides, if out-of-hours communication is part and parcel of the role, a useful exercise between boss and employee might be an expectation settings meeting which allows for mutual consent.
Very interesting stuff. Mm. Do keep them coming in if you have more opinions. Again, the WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899, or of course we're on Twitter at BFM Radio. Moving on to story number four. Vietnam Airlines then.
And a bunch of other airlines. It's a very weird thing that they're doing, because some of these Southeast Asian airlines, they want to have non-stop flights to the US, even though it won't be profitable for them. So it starts with Vietnam Airlines. They admit that they will struggle to be profitable if they provide non-stop flights between Vietnam and the US, because there's no real demand from business travelers for that kind of option. But they're still going to launch it in 2019, end of 2019 anyway. This whole thing is part of a movement by a few Southeast Asian airlines like Thai Airways and even Malaysia Airlines who are trying to balance government desires for growth with what is best for the airline's positioning in a competitive market. The logic here is, and according to Vietnam Airlines, is that they want to help the economy while trying to be viable and profitable. Even though most of their intercontinental routes don't make any money, they just do it to help people get around. I don't know how far that is true.
It sounds a little bit too...
I don't think you have a service to just help people get around if you can't make money off it. Most flights from this region have a layover or transfer because of distance. Any flight you take from here or even Thailand or even Vietnam. There are some exceptions like the Philippines Airlines, because they have a slightly shorter, more economical path to the US, to the West Coast cities specifically.
Right.
And Singapore Airlines, they launched like a 17.5-hour non-stop flight from its Singapore hub to San Francisco last year because... Singapore. And Singapore also plans to have even longer flights to LA and New York later this year. There is some new technology that might help direct flights to the US. There's the Boeing 787 Dreamliner. There's the Airbus A350. They have longer ranges and are more fuel efficient. And another reason Singapore can pull off non-stop flights is because of their reputation. Singapore Airlines is known for its quality and a high volume of business travelers and to and from the US, which makes it easier for them to configure their aircrafts that way. And they can even charge for a lot of premium seats for one-stop, non-stop flights between Singapore and the US. But with Vietnam and like Thailand and even Malaysia, you can't charge the same kind of premiums that Singapore does. The kind of premium that should make it profitable for these airlines to have non-stop flights to the US.
Especially when Singapore Airlines are regularly voted the best airline in the world.
Yeah, and even for Vietnam Airlines, they're saying that they have about 2 million Vietnamese living in the US, but the airlines cannot depend on that number because most of them don't come under business travel. Visiting friends and family is a casual thing, and most of the people wouldn't mind cheaper flights if it means like one layover or two stops or whatever in between, which basically defeats the purpose of having a non-stop option because it makes no business sense. Vietnam Airlines is still aiming for the end of 2019, but if things are too tough, they'll pull the plug and close the project altogether. So I guess it's a kind of a weird business strategy, but they're still going ahead to maybe test and see if it works. They don't have enough business travelers. It'll be fun to see if Malaysia does the same thing, because that would be flying to the US is hectic.
When you went, I know you've been before. Mm-hmm. How did you get there? What was your kind of
plan? We stopped in Paris, and then we went straight to Miami, and then from Miami it was to New Orleans.
So KL, Charles de Gaulle.
Yes.
And then to Miami. And then to
New Orleans. Yeah, wow. So it was like, I think a whole day it took.
Oh my word.
Or slightly longer than that. Because the layover in Paris was about 4 hours, and then Miami another 2 hours. Mm. And so it was like, it was a 12-hour flight, and then it was a 10-hour flight, and then it was a 2-hour flight.
I mean, from a customer perspective, I'm just grateful for any kind of direct flight to anywhere. I hate layovers with every fiber of my being. I know that they, make flights easier and cheaper and sometimes things like that. But I'm the kind of person that will absolutely knock out on a plane. And if that can be uninterrupted by me having to get up and go through an airport and then go through another airport and then go through another airport to get to the last airport, that would be fantastic. But I also have a concern in terms of, for me personally, I've never been to the U.S., which you would not be able to tell by the way I sound. but I've never been there. And I feel like for me, my priorities are more, getting there in the first place rather than the actual flight itself. I don't mind doing layovers, especially somewhere that is literally on the opposite end of the planet. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
Go on.
I mean, didn't you say that you almost missed because of the clashing times?
Like I was flying to the this is very recently I was flying to the UK and I was flying via Dubai. And when I booked the ticket, there was enough space of me landing for the transfer. There's enough time in the transfer window. Yet when I landed, for some reason, I landed at 8:45. I landed at 9:05 a.m. and my next flight was boarding at 8:45 a.m.
Oh.
So I landed after I was supposed to be boarding.
Oh.
I was the moment the plane landed, I was literally running through the airport to get onto my next flight. Mm. And it was final call before I got on. So those kind of moments are terrifying for me. So,
yeah.
Like you were saying,
Christine. Had a similar moment as well.
Right.
Because we got, I think in the same term, in Dubai as well, where my family were flying, I think from the UK. And we had a really, really long layover period. We actually took a nap because we were exhausted.
Right.
And then we woke up to, we took a nap at our gate, woke up to them having changed our gate, and it was final call. So we had to sprint all the way across the airport to get to the other gate because they had not announced it or anything. It's just that we looked up at the board and the board had changed.
Wow.
So we panicked. We just sprinted and then we were literally the last people on the plane. But that was that was not okay.
What was it they were saying? They're doing it to help people get around?
That's what they're saying now. Most of the intercontinental flights don't make money, but they just do it to help people get around and to help the economy. That's the thing. I mean, commercial airlines, I don't think you do anything just to help someone get around.
Never. Like Christine's just saying, they don't help anybody, if they don't have to.
Yeah.
They make jet-lagged people sprint through an airport at 3 a.m.
Exactly. And I'm someone who, I hate long flights. Yeah. It's uncomfortable. The seats are, there's no leg room and stuff. But even I wouldn't mind if there was a non-stop flight. I would rather have that than to get down and to run through airports and take a bus to another terminal.
I'll take sleep over running any day.
All right, we're going to take a break. Music coming up from The Strokes, The Modern Age, when we get back. How EA are unsurprisingly one of America's most hated companies yet again. Don't go anywhere. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Build financial mountains. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise BizBytes. Almost time for us to wrap up for the day. But before we go, we have, of course, a final story about some villains, otherwise known as EA.
Yeah. So EA is unsurprisingly one of America's most hated companies again. Their notorious reputation has been cemented after the financial news publication 24/7 Wall Street published its 2017 edition of America's Most Hated Companies, which ranks American companies based on reasons such as negligence and deceptive business practices. With 2017, quote, marred with revelations of corporate scandals, many more businesses and organizations have found themselves on the list. Now, the research comes from the American Customer Satisfaction Index, Glassdoor employee reviews, and findings from 24/7 Wall Street's Customer Satisfaction Survey, and it concluded with EA standing at fifth place. They are the fifth most hated company in America. The top four comprises of, actually, no, I'll save that for, I have the full list of the 20 most hated companies later, so I'll do that later. Obviously, this comes from the backlash for the Star Wars Battlefront 2 loot box controversy.
Let me give you a quick update to that. You know, they took out the microtransaction, yep. right? Mm-hmm. Which everybody was like rejoicing. They've now decided they're going to bring them back in.
Yes, I was literally about to say. The whole thing, this whole controversy, which locked game content behind massive paywalls, made the company suffer a whopping $3.1 billion drop in shareholder value and 8.5 drop in share prices.
Serves you right.
On top of other questionable practices such as buying up video game companies only to run them into the ground within years or even months of acquisition.
Yep.
And a nonprofit consumer affairs website, The Consumerist, labeled EA as the worst company in America in 2012 and 2013 and said that, I love this, EA and its ilk deliberately hold back game content with the sole intent of charging a fee for it at a later date. Fantastic.
Yes.
Things, however, may be looking out for EA nonetheless as the company sees some financial recovery and optimistic stock prices after the storm. Like you said, Rich, they're even returning. They're bringing back the microtransactions that got them into this in the first place, which this is why you're on this list.
I mean, if you've been bitten by a snake once, you don't put your hand back in the snake pit.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
This is why you're on the list, EA. Just this is why. But EA basically has little room for further mistakes. Now, here's the full list, counting down from 20 of America's most hated companies in 2017, because I love all of this. 20, the Weinstein Company.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, yes.
19, United Airlines, okay. Lest we forget that whole scandal. 18, Facebook. Mm-hmm. 17, CenturyLink. Then 16, Monsanto. 15, Comcast. Comcast. 14, Uber. 13, Sears Holdings. 12, the Trump Organization.
Well, why is he not number one? Moving on.
11, Wells Fargo. 10, Cigna. 19, Spirit Airlines. 88, Vice Media. That's a big one. Yeah. After the Me Too hashtag. 7, Sprint. 6, Foxconn Technology Group. 5, EA. 4, University of Phoenix.
That's interesting.
Wow.
Because I actually haven't said why the University of Phoenix is on there, but it's on there. The 3 is the NFL. Number 2 is Fox Entertainment Group. And taking the spot for number 1 is Equifax.
Ah, interesting.
NFL
list.
Is at number 3?
NFL is at number 3.
Right. The Super Bowl would say otherwise.
Mm. Of course they would.
Yeah. They just, over the weekend, I think, what, huge ratings or something. Yeah. Like the most
ratings, I think, are separate from how the company works as a whole. And there's been a lot of issues with, I think, some sociopolitical stuff when it comes to making statements.
Take
during
a knee.
Football matches.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. No wonder that people are coming. University of Phoenix, so that's an interesting one. Do we know why? Why
I don't actually know why that's on the list. It wasn't in the article as far as I know, but, you know, it's, I don't know, man.
Hey, wait, wasn't the University of Phoenix where there were protests last year and somebody was run over?
Yes.
Was that University of Phoenix?
I feel like that might have been the Tiki Torches incident.
I think it was the University of Phoenix right there.
Yes.
Okay, that explains it. I understand now. I feel better and knowledgeable. Right.
Yeah, a lot of names.
I think a lot of those names on that list are well deserved as well. Maybe we should do a list of Malaysia's most hated companies. No, we're not going to do that. Just teasing.
Let's not do that.
Right, okay. It's time for us to wrap up, of course. Interesting show today. We started off with how a new Lego invention can sort cells and molecules.
Then we spoke about how Funding Societies and Money Match launched a partnership to provide alternative financial solutions for SMEs.
Then we talked about how the CEO of Barstool Sports Defense tested job candidates by texting them at weird hours on weekend, and also thank you to people who messaged in today.
And then about how Southeast Asian Airlines are looking to have non-stop US flights despite profit challenges.
And finally, we talked about how EA is, unsurprisingly, one of America's most hated companies again.
It is indeed. Right, there you go, folks. That's all we've covered for today. If you have missed any part of this show, feel free to download our podcast. You can use the BFM app. It's available, of course, from the Apple App Store or from Google Play, or you can head over to bfm.my/podcast if you really want to and do it from there. Meanwhile, don't go anywhere, because coming up after the 1 o'clock news, we have the Breakfast Grill replay. It's Datuk Wirabu Kwang Loon, the CEO of Yong Thai Berhad. They're pinning high hopes on their development projects within Impression City Melaka. The project is expected to draw in a good volume of tourists, so the CEO shared his thoughts this morning on the future of local tourism. That's all coming up after the 1 o'clock news. I'm Rich Bradbury on behalf of Christine Wong and Arvind Uvaraj. We will, of course, be back tomorrow at noon. Meanwhile, some Kooks. How do you like that here on BFM 89.9, the business station?
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.